Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to Friday, and welcome to Alive to Thrive with Brenda Fraser. Each week, Brenda brings you interesting guests and timely topics to uplift and motivate you to be all that you can be today and for all your tomorrows. Join Brenda and Alive to Thrive every Friday at noon Central Time, right here on Greater Good Ministries Radio. And now, here's Brenda Fraser.
Hello, and welcome to Alive to Thrive. My name is Brenda Fraser, and with this special month of March, we're honoring Women's History Month, and we have a very special guest today on the line from New York City, who was the first woman auctioneer for Sotheby's. But what is more fascinating is that she actually went on to the slums of Calcutta and worked alongside Mother Teresa and the Sisters of Charity to work and find her spiritual path. She's written two books. We'll be talking about her first book, The Camel Knows the Way, author and speaker Lorna Kelly. Hello, Lorna. Are you with us today?
I certainly am. Hello, Brenda. Nice to hear you.
Well, it's so thrilling. I feel like this has been something part of my spiritual journey for 8 or 9 years. I had heard someone gave me a copy of one of your speeches, and it was riveting. It stayed with me all these years, and I was so blown away by imagining a New York City successful career woman leaving everything behind, going halfway around the world by yourself, no less, and literally showing up in India, knocking on the convent door. I can't even imagine the courage that took and the passion you had to really answer some spiritual questions for yourself firsthand. So let's first start with your early career days in New York. Brenda, before you go on,
because I think you've painted a picture that's not, it's sort of right, but no, not really. I did not leave Sotheby's to go and join Mother Teresa. I didn't at all. It wasn't that highfalutin. It wasn't that sort of selfless, brave thing. I was working at Sotheby's, and I went off to India to see it. I never thought I'd get caught up with it or anything. I didn't go with any great spiritual motivation or anything in my heart like that. It was in the being there that I was moved, but certainly not before I went.
Well, I think that's a testament to your being very humble. But so you did go wanting to, out of curiosity, having read a book someone loaned to you, and I'd like to talk about that too later in the program. But let's first start with your life in New York, because you lived a very unusual life, building a career and a name for yourself as a prominent auctioneer, the first woman auctioneer in the country, for Sotheby's and or for any organization for that matter. How did you land up in that role, and what did that take to become an auctioneer?
Uh-huh. Well, I actually, you know how life steers us in different directions, totally differently from how we imagined. And I was thinking I wanted to be a dancer, a modern ballet dancer, and I was really heavily at classes, and I was really thinking of turning professional, and I was doing temporary secretarial work on the side to support myself. And one day, the agency I worked through, we're talking years ago now, the agency I worked through sent me to Sotheby's, it was just before Christmas, to type labels to put on this very glossy art book that they were sending to very good clients for as Christmas presents. And when I crossed the threshold of Sotheby's, and I remember arguing with the agency because Sotheby's was way uptown and I lived downtown, and I said, don't you have anything a little closer to where I live? And they said, no, we'll just do it for the day and we'll find you something else tomorrow. And as soon as I crossed the threshold of Sotheby's, I was captivated. I didn't even know. I knew nothing whatsoever about the auction business, but I loved the hustle and the bustle and the action and the being around beautiful things and people that were dressed beautifully and people that, you know, were living on a totally different level than I was living. And I just, the second day I was there, they asked me to come back the second day, and the second day I was there, they found out I could take shorthand, which that dates me. I knew Pittman shorthand and I can type. And they offered me a job. And I just like that, boom, I let go of my desire to be on the stage as a dancer, and I knew I wanted to be in the auction business.
Well, it's funny how there is a divine right order in life, because I actually, through a temporary job, ended up at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, D.C., and I was the first non-Jewish person they hired. But it's amazing to me when we're going through things that we don't realize the divine right order, but then in reflection and looking back, we see how everything fell into place perfectly with or without our, you know, control of those things, that there is some kind of higher power kind of directing our lives. And I think that's an interesting message to get across to people, that wherever you are in life, you are in the exact right place where you need to be.
I sometimes think that maybe God took mercy on me and the rest of mankind by not letting me set foot on stage.
Yeah. But you're on a different sort of stage. And so what was that like, learning the business and breaking into a man's world? Was that difficult? Did you have mentors?
Actually, it was, I was still, you know, taking dancing classes. I didn't let go of it entirely. I mean, it was difficult from doing that rigorous kind of classes to stopping entirely. I still went in the evenings to classes. And then I was just a secretary. And then they asked, someone in the Japanese department asked me to join there. And I was a secretary to that guy in the Japanese department. And then one day he was over the top with frustration to getting a catalog out on time. And he threw a whole load of what's called Netsuke in front of me, Netsuke and lacquer items. And he said, catalog them. And I got every book down off the shelf to describe them. And I really didn't know what I was talking about. But gradually, I learned. And, you know, you just make a few mistakes. And in the auction business, mistakes mean money. And so you learn very, very quickly the difference between 18th and 19th century and how to recognize the good from the better. And so I became an expert in a particular area of Japanese art. And then when it came time for the sale, and all the experts had to do this, you turn your sale over to an auctioneer. It's not, and you can decide the auctioneer you want. You can request a certain auctioneer. But I thought, I didn't want to turn my baby over to someone else, having given birth to it. I wanted to see it through to the end. And I decided to ask the president of the company if I could be an auctioneer. Now, by this time, Sotheby's was about 240 years old. I mean, it was it was founded when George Washington was 10 years old, and it never had a woman stepped into the rostrum. And I didn't think of it of, well, I'm going to be a woman. I just thought of it, I want to do this. And I shared it with a few of my associates there, and they just were so amused that I had the temerity to go and ask if I could be an auctioneer. They just thought it was hilarious. And anyway, I went off to the president's office. I sat down, and I said, you know, I had this huge speech laid out about why I should be an auctioneer. And then, of course, he was going to say no. And then I had an addendum to it that to say some more. And I sat down at his desk, and I said to him, John, I'd really like to be an auctioneer. And he said to me, he thought for a minute, he said, you know, I think that's a great idea. And I was blown out of the water, and I was like almost stuttering because I thought, well, I've got this whole speech. I need to deliver my speech. And he said, you know, why don't you come to my office in a couple of days' time or something, and we'll start classes. And that's how it happened. It was that simple. And I've never thought of it as I broke through into a man's world and I broke through this ceiling. I thought, in reflection, I think I did it, and I was the first woman to do it because no woman had asked before.
And I think that is so key, that we do have to ask for what we want, and whether it's a passion for, you know, his Japanese art or whatever our passion is, but to take that passion, use it as the fuel, the fire in the belly to ask for what we want and not to live in the shadows. So you did ask, and when did you realize later in your career, or was it only after you left Sotheby's, the certain importance of that role that you kind of paved the way for other women to follow?
I never really, it's only years later, and even all these years later, it was almost 30, over 30 years later, I mean, I'm sitting on a panel next week for addressing young girls, and I've been asked, because there's three of us women, and the three of us are the first in our fields, and, you know, I'm the first woman auctioneer, so other people thought it was extraordinary, and at the time it was considered extraordinary, the news was blasted all across America. And, I mean, it was actually the other people viewed it as the equivalent of the first woman on the floor of the stock exchange. It was that big. But for myself, for my own inner life, I didn't see, I just saw it as a continuation. I didn't see it as a breaking through barriers or anything like that. It was my job. And excuse me. And I liked doing it. It was fun. And it was great because
I do want to encourage our listeners to go to YouTube and type in Lorna's name, Lorna Kelly, Kelly, or go to her website, lornakelly.com. And watch some of the videos there of Lorna in her career as an auctioneer and some of the media, some of the interviews, as they say, back in the day. Fascinating stuff. I'm so glad you're sharing those videos with all of us because it is an important piece of history. And whether you realize it when you're going through it or later looking back, I think it does set you up as a role model to encourage other women to think outside the box and to ask and to take chances. And so a big chance you took was your trip to Calcutta. Tell us about how you were first sort of introduced to, you know, the story of Mother Teresa and her work and becoming intrigued, as you say, intrigued by her life and being a spiritual warrior. Tell us that story about reading the book and how that inspired you.
I have to give the details leading up to it. It didn't just boom happen in my life. There was little steps, little steps, little steps. I was to, you know, as my career was advancing, And as I was getting all this publicity and things, my self-esteem was getting lower and lower and lower. And I was to discover, through help with other people, that I had a problem with alcohol. And I reached out for help, or someone reached to me and told me I needed help. And I got help with the group of people, and one of the essential elements of recovery is to develop a spiritual life. And so I started on that path, and I just became fascinated with the life of Christ. I'm not a born again, I'm not an evangelical, I'm not that, but I just thought of him as this sort of fantastic spiritual warrior that put his money where his mouth was, and he was no people pleaser, and he was, I just found him very intriguing. He was very annoying in his day, and embarrassing, and people are still embarrassed by him. I mean, you can mention that name and clear a room. So, but my secretary knew, and she gave me this book, because I was reading about other people that had been fascinated with his life, and of course they were all dead a couple of hundred years. But she gave me this book by an Englishman called Malcolm Muggeridge, and it was about this woman in Calcutta called Mother Teresa. And being a people pleaser, I really didn't want to read about some do-good little nun halfway around the world. I mean, I knew about this woman. I knew she'd won a Nobel Prize. But that's about it. But I read this book. It had large print and lots of pictures. And it was an eye-opener. And very shortly after that, there was a special on television about her. And I watched the special. And at the end of the special, the commentator said that Mother Teresa was a living saint. And I thought, oh, yes. Well, let me go see this living saint. And I think that God rendered me temporarily insane. I don't know whether I thought I was going to West Virginia or something, but I mean, I booked, the next day I went to the office, and in those days, you know, there was no internet, I called the travel agent and I booked a round trip ticket to Calcutta. And 3 weeks later, I was on a plane to Calcutta. And, you know, I'd just come from Madison Avenue with my long red fingernails, Cadillac red, and I arrived in Calcutta. And I wanted to see the work, because there's a piece in the Gospel of John where Jesus says, if you don't believe me, believe me for the work's sake. I mean, look at the results. Even if you don't believe what I'm telling you, here are the results. So I wanted to see what that kind of concentration and dedication and unconditional love, what it looked like produced. What was the result of that? I mean, we all can say, you know, well, I've got unconditional love. Yes, I've got unconditional love until you irritate me, and then I don't want to do it anymore. But she got up every single day and dressed herself in that same old outfit and went out onto the streets and set up this huge, the Missionaries of Charity, which are her sisters, to minister to the poorest of the poor. And I wanted to see what that kind of dedication looked like. It's the same dedication that Henry Ford had to produce a car that everyone could afford, that single-mindedness. And so I arrived in Calcutta. I didn't want to tell them I was coming, because I knew they needed an auctioneer like a hole in the head. You know, I'm not a nurse, I'm not a doctor. And I thought that they would say, well, the money you were going to spend on your airfare, please send that to us. Don't bother coming yourself. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I showed up. I got into a taxi cab at Calcutta Airport, and I went to the address that was in the book my secretary had given me, and I pulled the door chain, and that's how it began.
And I understand through your book, we want to mention that title again, The Camel Knows the Way, that what I love about your book, and you talk about that very first visit to Calcutta and the horrific conditions of the poorest of the poor living on the street, and the lack of sanitation, the lack of clean water, the lack of so many different things from American standards. I can't imagine the culture shock. But then going to the House of the Dying, it's pronounced, Calicut? Is that what you
Calicut,
said?
Calicut, yes.
Calicut. And then basically, you know, being left with a woman who was dying, had had severe burns over her body, and being told, you know, okay, you need to figure this out, and everyone else is dealing with emergencies and crises and extreme situations beyond the imagination. I don't think anyone can imagine what the situation was like there, even reading the book, which is very visual, and I commend you on the incredible descriptions you had of the scenes that you witnessed. But talk to us about that, that first act of, to me, it was your first act of pure love, pure service, where you're faced with a situation and you had to just sort of figure it out or use divine guidance or something. But
yeah.
Tell us about that woman and that burn victim and that story, please.
Well, everything you say is true, you know, and the harvest is plenty, the laborers are few. And I wasn't actually at the House of the Dying. It was another missionary of charity center. And I was there that particular morning, and this woman had been brought in. She'd been found on the railroad tracks or by the railroad tracks. And she had crawled there trying to throw herself under a train. And she was the victim of probably bride burning. You know, where she hadn't bought a big enough dowry to the marriage or something, and the mother-in-law or the husband will set the sari on fire and say that she died, you know, heating milk or something. I mean, you can't imagine the horrors that some of the women go through. Well, just that recently, look at that young girl that was brutally raped in Delhi and left, and no one would help her. Her boyfriend was screaming for help, and they just left her and treated her dreadfully. Anyway, I was there, and the sister that I was talking to had an emergency visit to go and get a delivery of food for the center. And she turned to me, and she said to me, "You deal with her." I don't think she understood that I was an auctioneer, that I knew nothing whatsoever about anything. So I'm left with this. They all leave, and there's this woman that's like a charred mess on the floor in front of me, and I have no idea what to do, and she's filthy. And I said, well, you know, I knew to wash her. I knew that I should try and clean her up. But all the time, I got her into a room where there was a cistern and like a well of water, and I just pulled out the water, the container, and threw it on her and washed her. And I just absolutely blocked out her screaming. I just blocked it out. I couldn't hear it. And I just prayed that she'd die. I hoped, prayed and prayed and prayed that she would die and that she'd be out of this pain. But she didn't die. And
she actually went on to be, she actually survived that. And,
yes, she
and,
survived
and it. What a feeling to know that you helped save someone's life. I think there's no greater joy, no material success, no recognition, nothing we can do in our lives can match that feeling, you know, of being there of service to someone else. And perhaps that's why all of us are here on this planet and to reconnect. So in terms of how many times did you go back, or over the course of how many years were you traveling back and forth to Calcutta, each time saying, "I'm not coming back. This is my last trip."
Well, the first trip was in 1981, and Mother died in 97. So in those years, I went back quite a few times. And then I'd also meet Mother in other parts of the world, in Rome, and she loved coming to New York. I've been to her sisters in Africa, in Egypt, in Gaza, and in various places in America. She's got lots of houses here. And
I was very intrigued by your comments about having philosophical discussions with her and arguing about different viewpoints and thoughts and beliefs. And I just find that fascinating that you have this exchange of ideas. Talk about that a little bit,
well,
about these conversations.
I often wondered why we were so close. And it definitely was a closeness. And the others in the order, sometimes it created a little a sort of pain with the other sisters, because they said, you know, I've been with Mother all these years and she never gives me the time she gives you. And I think it was because I came at her not that impressed in the beginning. I was a bit ignorant.
You're a doubting Thomas. You sort of came
as a
skeptic.
Not a doubting Thomas. I thought, I'm a famous woman too. Do you know?
Yes.
And what is this saint business, you know?
Oh,
and
my goodness.
She could be, people will say to me these days, and we argued, and I think she liked that, because I wasn't groveling at her feet and going, oh, mother, I wasn't talking about the Blessed Virgin or Jesus or this, that, and other. We argued. And
you had a relationship of equals, where two women,
yes,
coming together despite very different backgrounds, different upbringings, different life circumstances, you shared the commonality of understanding, seeking to understand, you know, what is the meaning of life and what is our purpose and how do we, how do we find humility? I mean,
Well, it's not so much humility, it's how do I learn to love on a deeper way? And, you know, I want to share this, that, we don't need to go to Calcutta to see the poor. We're surrounded with poverty. I mean, I live in New York, just off Park Avenue. I don't live in the Park Avenue apartment, I can assure you, but I live off Park Avenue, and I see women that are having their fifth facelift, or, you know, they have to have a certain handbag or get their kids into a certain school. And if that's not poverty, that's a form of poverty, of thinking I'm not going to be enough unless I have, or unless I look a certain way. And, you know, I'm impatient. And Mother once was very kind to me about my impatience. And I think she recognized it, because she was impatient too, very impatient. And that's a kind of poverty too, that to be impatient. It's sort of ignorant, actually. And so how poor am I that I can't wait, or that I just have to get things moving my way, you know. There's all types and forms of poverty. It's not just those that are in need of a piece of bread.
And so in terms of working among the poorest of the poor and having it right here in our own backyard, I'd like to talk a little bit about, you know, people look at a Martin Luther King or a Gandhi or a Mother Teresa, and they're in this sort of elite level of, you know, spiritual heroes, and they're untouchable, and people can't relate to them, perhaps. But what are some first steps, some very beginning baby steps that people can take to become either more spiritually aware or more connected to others in their own community?
Ah, good question. I think people often ask me, you know, what was the most striking thing about Mother? And the most striking thing about Mother was her genuineness, her authenticity. And she was very ordinary. And she didn't have a sense of grabbing for anything. She just let things flow. It didn't mean to say that she was laid back, because she wasn't. She produced a great deal. I mean, I always say I think she could have run the Pentagon, you know. But she had a focus in her life, and she stuck with that focus in a loving, compassionate way, and didn't let anything interfere with that, and wasn't pulled off course by the naysayers in her life, you know, because she had a lot of people that thought she was a crackpot, but she kept going. And I think, you know, it's the same for Martin Luther King. A lot of people thought he was a crackpot, and all the great saints, you read their lives, Gandhi, you read their lives, they're, you know, people will often say to me when I'm acting out, they'll say, oh my God, Lorna, you know, what would Mother Teresa think if she saw you doing this or being so impatient? And I say, you think I'm bad? You should have been around her. I'm a saint compared to her.
Well,
and I do think that, you know, we expect these people, as you've just said, to be on a different level. Usually they are very irritating and go against the grain. That's why so many saints were burned at the stake, and they were thrown down wells and gotten rid of and assassinated, because they're irritating.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And so talking about that, one of the things that well, we probably should take a break. We're gonna take a short station identification and a two-minute break. We'll be right back. We want to continue talking about this concept of making a difference on the local level, and perhaps maybe you have to be a little bit rebellious or a little bit, you know, able to ignore criticism. So we'll be right back. You're listening to Alive to Thrive. My name is Brenda Fraser. Our guest today is Lorna Kelly, author of The Camel Knows the Way, as well as another book we'll be talking about after the break. She's an author, a speaker, and was the first woman auctioneer for Sotheby's. So we'll be right back in a short minute.
Hi, everybody. This is Geddy Lee for RAD. To many of us, drunk driving is something that other people do. Certainly not one of our friends or relatives would do such a thing. When you see someone who's had too much to drink, about to get into a car, urge them to give up the keys and find alternate transportation. Always choose a designated driver. Remember, music lives, you should too.
A public service message brought to you by the U.S. Department of Transportation, RAD, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
We're open for business. The Greater Good Ministries Book and Gift Shop is now open for business, featuring metaphysical and uplifting books from your favorite authors, such as Doreen Virtue, Wayne Dyer, Michael Edward Owens. We've added handcrafted one-of-a-kind jewelry, pendants, earrings, and bracelets, and now have an exclusive selection of crystals, rocks, and stones for your metaphysical toolbox. Take a look at our hand-dug Arkansas crystals, imported Brazilian crystals, Tibetan crystals, and Reiki healing stones. All of our rocks, crystals, and stones have been Reiki infused, blessed, and cleared, ready for use. You can reserve your copy of Crystal Healing 2012 and Beyond, Reverend B's new book, A Comprehensive Guide of Rocks, Crystals, and Stones for the New Age. Visit ggmradio.com. and click Bookshop in the menu bar. That's ggmradio.com.
You're listening to Alive to Thrive with Brenda Fraser on GGM Radio. And now, back to the show.
Hello and welcome back to Alive to Thrive. We're talking with Lorna Kelly about her travels to Calcutta and knowing Mother Teresa over a 16-year period. And one of the things in her book, The Camel Knows the Way, Lorna talks about how when the missionaries of charity, the Sisters of Charity, first went to India, they met with some resistance. people didn't trust their motives, I guess, initially. Can you talk a little bit about that, Lorna?
Yes, and they are called the missionaries of charity, and they didn't go to India. They're from India. Mother was worked in a rather nice school in India, and she got her training in Ireland, and then in the days of the British Raj, we're talking, you know, 30s, 40s here, she went to India, and she entered this very nice girls' school, and then 20 years she was there, 19, 20 years, and she left to go because she felt she got a call within a call and that God was asking her to leave her comfortable convent life and go out onto the streets and minister to him in the form of the poorest of the poor. And she went, and a lot of her girls that she'd been teaching at school, Brahmin, high-caste girls, joined her. And that's how it started. And yes, in the beginning, the Hindus, especially at Kalighat, which had been a Hindu temple, it had been actually where the pilgrims visiting the temple stayed, felt that she was converting them to Hinduism, and she was not at all. She was just ministering. And, you know, her thing is not to... There's been a lot of stuff in the papers just recently within the last few days about how she had millions and millions of dollars and she could have built hospitals if she'd wanted to instead of what she did, but she opened hundreds of houses all over the world. And her thing wasn't about, you know, giving people heart surgery. Her thing was about human contact. That's what she felt that people were lacking, was, you know, someone loving them, someone being with them, someone holding them. She thought that was the greatest poverty when she came to America and saw how many terribly lonely older people there were on the streets. So it really grew up within India. There, and of course there was a lot of controversy. There's this woman, this Catholic nun in a Hindu Muslim country, you know, doing this very nothing work that a well-caste Indian would never touch, an untouchable. And so that's why, you know, it caused a lot of, you know, if someone's doing something wonderful and you're living in completely the opposite way, it makes you feel uncomfortable because it highlights what you're not doing.
And I think there's sort of, I think once you have the knowledge of suffering, you almost have a moral responsibility to respond to it in some way. And so I think people try to ignore even learning the stories or connecting because they know that once they're aware, they're gonna either be haunted by guilt or they're gonna have to step up and do something.
Yes.
And I love that you said that she was talking about how to love in a deeper way. And one of the things that you've done in your life, which to me is a demonstration of love and service, and using your skills and talents as an auctioneer, is helping to raise millions of dollars for the Broadway Cares Equity Fights Against AIDS, and doing these auctions in the theater district over the course of many years. Do you still do those events, or how many years did you do that? Really?
Absolutely, yes. I'm a freelance auctioneer, and I do events for Broadway Cares Equity Fights AIDS. We've raised millions of dollars over the last years. And, you know, in the very beginning, a lot of people wouldn't touch AIDS with a 10-foot pole. Mm-hmm. And this particular organization has been amazing for, for instance, supposing a young man was affected with AIDS and his family lived in the Midwest and were poor, the Broadway Cares community would bring that family here and provide accommodation and food for them while they were here and things like that. So it's an amazing, compassionate organization, and I'm really happy to be associated with them. I think it's a great honor. And yes, the disease is quelled a lot, but it's rampant. among it's rampant among different sectors of the community, young Spanish girls and Orthodox Jewish ladies, actually, because their men go to prostitutes and carry it. It's amazing how high AIDS is in that community. And so it's and Broadway Cares also helps women on women's issues. They, I had cancer, and they helped me with that with some financially. So it's a magnificent organization.
Well, and the theater district and the arts community was so decimated in the 80s. I mean,
yes.
I volunteered with the AIDS Memorial Quilt and all the big international displays on the National Mall. And and I'll never forget meeting mothers who had lost sons who actually told me about being with different people, whether, their sons or their friends of their sons, and the death and dying process. And to be there was like being a midwife, and to help coach someone over and to help coach them to let go of this physical world for the spiritual world. And that advice came in handy for me when I was with my aunt dying of Alzheimer's. And I remembered those words of those mothers who had lost their sons. And they were spiritual warriors in their own way.
Yes.
But have you lost any friends? Did you know anyone in the arts community in New York City?
Oh, absolutely.
You lost friends?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, in the 80s, because I'm in recovery circles, there were lots of guys in those days that were also recovered from drug addiction, mm-hmm. and they were it was rampant. I can't tell you how many funerals we all went to. And visiting people in hospitals. And I started going into hospitals and volunteering on the AIDS wards when they shut them down the end of the corridor and didn't go in and see them. They didn't want to. It was almost like they wore hazmat suits to go.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd go in and see a darling friend of mine, and he'd be, lying in his own filth because no one had changed him.
Mm-hmm. And the fear and the hysteria that now...
Yes.
As we know through scientific research and AIDS awareness, that was so overblown and overdone that isolated people dying with AIDS. And so, were you involved in that that community of response before you had gone to Calcutta, or did that come after?
It came after, because I went to Calcutta first in 81, and AIDS was just starting to come around, just one or two. And then
Sorry. Well, I was just going to say, did you see that your work in Calcutta helped prepare you, having seen suffering up close?
Yes.
Because
people
that haven't dealt with suffering up close, it takes a special kind of person, really, to...
Well, I don't think it's even the suffering. I think it's getting yourself prepared to see a body that wrecked, to see this vibrant, fabulous, beautiful young man looking so decrepit and covered in sores. That's the horror,
And one of the things you talk about from your visits in India, and this was very touching, is that sometimes when someone is suffering so immensely and you don't have medicine or painkillers or any of the things we have here in this country to ease the suffering, there's no morphine, that you can stroke their hair and look into their eyes, and just giving that person that sense of dignity by looking into their eyes and knowing that there's a person inside of there, the way you described that was very... very moving, and I think people forget about the power of love, that the power of love can heal, and just to give someone that respect of being a human person and having that human dignity.
And that's what Mother said, when she first started out and started in Calicut, she said, she picked up somebody from the street that was being eaten by rats and took him into this and washed him and cared for him and loved him, and he was going to die. And he said, I've lived my life, you know, like an animal, but I'm going to die like an angel.
I love that quote.
Because he was loved. People were hovering around him and caring for him. And, you know, he was a human being worthy of being touched.
Mm.
I mean, you know, how I often look at the people in New York on the streets, and they're shuffling along with their bags and this, that, and the other, and they're sleeping in doorways. And I think, you know, how long has it been since someone touched you?
Mm-hmm. And people won't even make eye contact. They just
no.
look away. They won't even make eye contact. What was it like? So talk to us about going through your breast cancer. You said that the group, the Broadway Cares, that you had helped so much over so many years, that they reached out and helped you. And what was that like when you first got your diagnosis and those early scary months of, you know, what was going to happen?
Well, you know, I was so blown away because I was diagnosed through a mammogram, and I had very lumpy breasts, and I was always being called back for a second thing. So when they called me back, I thought absolutely nothing of it. Then they said they wanted to do biopsy. I don't know whether I went into total shutdown denial, but I just kept plodding along with them going in. And then when the doctor called me one afternoon, I was called, and they don't call you unless, and they said, you know, we did a test on all three of our thing, and all three are positive. And I said, I got very British, and I said, oh, thank you so much. And I put the phone down. And, you know, it was only 10 minutes later that I realized, oh, my God, what did he say? I called back, and he said, I was waiting for your call. So, and it wasn't so much scary. That it was tiring being on top of everything, you know, because every test I took led to another test and another test. And someone said to me, you know, Lorna, you have to be your number one advocate. You
mm-hmm.
have to stay on top of everything. And I didn't fight it or anything. The only time I really broke down in tears, and I think this is common for women, was I had a double mastectomy. That was fine, all that, fine. It was when I started chemo after the operation healed, and I had to have my hair cut off. And I sat in the hairdresser's, and I wept. I couldn't stop crying. And I think that's because that's the real outward sign that something's wrong with you to the world, you know, because my breasts were covered. But this was, that I think it hit me long after the surgery and all that, because as soon as
so much of our identity, I mean, you could be First Lady of the United States and people always want to comment on someone's hair. How's that? But you have recovered now from that?
Yes, I'm well over 5 years out. So
wow,
they say 5 years is the magic. And, you know, they're on top of it and all that. But the aftermath of it has been very difficult. I had chemotherapy, and the chemotherapy I had rotted a piece of my heart. So the valve didn't fit in right. So 2 years ago, I had to have heart surgery. I've had blood clots. I've fallen down a lot. I've broken both my wrists. I've broken both my knees. I'm just, it's just been one thing after the other.
Well,
but I haven't fallen for quite a while now. Sorry?
I said, well, through all these trials and tribulations with your health, much like just the challenges of international travel and the things you did as a volunteer in India, what were some spiritual principles that guided you through your cancer treatment?
I think one of the things that has guided me very, very much, I meditate every day. I sit and I sit in meditation for a half hour. Sometimes I sit down and I say to my mind, all right, I'm going to concentrate on my breathing. I take an in-breath, and by the out-breath, I'm redecorating the apartment. And, you know, half an hour goes by and I haven't been there at all. But I do it. I show up and I do it, and I take that time. And I think one of the greatest tools in my life, and I say this with all sincerity, is to embrace my death. I've done a lot of Buddhist practices, and to embrace the fact that everything passes. You know, the Buddha said the most amazing thing in the world, with all evidence to the contrary, we don't think we're going to die. Mm. We say, yes, 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 I'm going to die, but I don't want to die this afternoon, and I don't want to do it right now, and we make all these plans. And I live constantly with my death, not in a morbid way, but I'm very aware. When I see a sunset, I think to myself, you are not guaranteed that you will see another one of these, so really take notice of it. Mm-hmm. You are not guaranteed you will be able to walk like this, you know, through the park, so make note of it. You are not guaranteed that you will ever see a delightful child like this again, so be aware. So being aware of my own death makes this moment much sweeter. And I'm very grateful for it.
Oh, that is so well said. I mean, I think that occurred to me after surviving a car crash that, you know, there is no suffering in the now. Eckhart Tolle wrote a book about that. But that having that attitude of gratitude and seeing that sunset, like you said, it may be your last, and taking a moment to be aware of the beauty in nature, the beauty all around us, the beauty in someone's eyes, and appreciating that as if it is your last day on earth, and living that way will always make life special and full of surprises. You have several things coming up that I want to make sure we talk about. We're running out of time already. I could talk to you for hours. I love it. A class coming up on how to write a memoir. Talk to us a little bit about that, and how can people register for that class?
Well, it's going to be very, very limited. It's going to be like 4 or 5 people, and they can go on my website and see all the stuff, or on Facebook or that. And it's I'm on Facebook, and it seems to me so many people say, I should write a book. I really want to write a book. By the thing of actually writing a book, you know. But the thing is, sitting down and starting it. So I want to help people. I know, you know, a lot of old people don't use a computer. And you know why? They don't know how to turn it on. And they're frightened to turn it on. Just that simple thing of turning the computer on. So
right.
The class is really to help people start and to talk about what writing a book is. And it's maybe not have it in the mind that I'm going to write a book, but have it in the mind I'm going to write. I have an interesting story to tell about when I was 8 years old and fell off the swing. I want to talk about that and just write that story.
Well, and I love the style of your book, The Camel Knows the Way, and I want to really encourage people to go online and order that book today, because it has not only Lorna's story about, you know, traveling to India and knowing and learning spiritual wisdom from Mother Teresa, but also flashbacks to your youth and things that formed you and learning about forgiveness and forgiving a parent that had alcoholism. I mean, so many people have alcoholism in their family.
Yes.
So many people have to learn to forgive one of their parents or both of their parents.
Yes.
But learning about forgiveness and how that is so freeing. And so I love the little flashbacks to your childhood in England and the descriptions of the school you went to and just different things that came into play later in your life when you looked back on some of these things that influenced you and then your life in New York and then your international life and now your life teaching through speaking, and people can book Lorna as a speaker. She's traveling nationally. If you check her website, there is a calendar of events. She might be coming to a city near you. I know in the Midwest she'll be in Indiana this October. She'll be in California. Where are you going in the next 60, 90 days? Where will you be this spring, Lorna?
Well, actually, on the 27th of this month, I go on a three-week silent retreat. So I'm meditating for 3 weeks in Massachusetts.
Wow.
So
do you do that every year?
Yes, I usually try to do it for much longer because I speak and I think it's important to be silent, you know. And actually, silence is the highest form of prayer. I love the thing. Have you ever heard of this? Someone said to Mother Teresa, you know, when you pray, what do you say? And she said, I don't say anything. I just listen. And the questioner asked her, well, what is God saying to you? And she said, he's not saying anything because he's listening too.
That's fantastic. I've never heard that before.
Yeah, and
That's
you know,
fantastic.
They say that heaven is thunderously silent. And it's only in the silence, really, that a true love evolves. When you're really in love with someone, the refrain is, we don't need to talk, we just understand each other. There's an understanding, you know, when you're madly in the throes of deep passion and love, you're not chatting. You know?
Wow. And it is all about love. And getting back to the earlier quote about Mother Teresa, you know, focusing on how do I love in a deeper way and how, you know, everybody has their own spiritual path and really through hardship and struggles and different life experiences, we evolve and have a greater spiritual awakening if we allow that to. Some people, you know, shut down when they have lost someone close to them. And sometimes they don't recover from that. They become bitter and they become stuck. But some of those experiences can be our greatest teachers. And I do like talking about these things on Alive to Thrive, which is why the name of the show is such, and in encouraging people to read books like The Camel Knows the Way. And your second book, what is the title of your second book, Lorna?
The
Tell
second
us about
book
that
is In the Footsteps of the Camel, and the best way to get them really is through Amazon. You can't find them in bookshops. You have to get them through Amazon.
Through Amazon, or you can go to lornakelly.com, print
yes.
out an order sheet, and mail that in, and maybe Lorna will autograph those for you.
Yes, I will autograph it.
Okay, and we really want to encourage folks to go to Lorna Kelly's Facebook page, like the page, tell your friends about these books. They are life-changing, and they will provoke deep thought and will give you some little spiritual tips, just like she was saying, just getting silent and meditating and going within to find God. I love that.
And the YouTube videos that you were referring to are on YouTube.com. Books by Lorna. That's where all those clips of recovery and me from 30 years ago in the rostrum of Sotheby's.
Well, they're timeless. You know, beauty is timeless. And you are a beautiful person inside and out. And I just want to thank you again because, again, I think you continue to share your message, your lessons. And you continue to bring the words of Mother Teresa through you, I mean, through your channel. And I just am very touched and honored that we have connected. And I hope that we can continue the conversation. And as you continue to lecture and write more books, that we'll have you back on the show at a future time. So thank you so much. And
thank
have a blessed
so
day.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
The light would shine.
The That's how I feel.